sort of founders of the second wave of the operational approach to understanding quantum theory and various theories, and also for a long time has been working on getting general relativity and quantum theory together, possibly using the operational framework to help. And we're going to talk about GR and the operational framework today.
Great. Thank you. This is work in progress. I'm slowly writing the paper up. Should be out later this year. The objective of this work is to develop an operational formulation of general relativity, and it should be one that accommodates ignorance probabilities, just straightforward ignorance of the values of things, and also the notion of agency, so the idea that people can choose settings one way or another. I call this pager, so that's probabilistic general relativity with agency. You'll notice that the A is out of sequence. But that's actually a feature, because in probabilistic general relativity, you'll have some kind of fuzzy causal structure. And the name pager also doubles up as homage to the BlackBerry pager, which got this whole place started. And the motivation for developing pager is that it's a stepping stone to developing a theory of quantum gravity, which I call Quager, which I think will be the next version in the BlackBerry operating system or something. just a quick prelude. So at the back of my mind in this work for a long time has been these ideas of composition in physics. So the idea that you should do physics by thinking about composing objects. So the idea is that you have objects, I'm thinking of operational objects, and associated with those objects are things called generalized states. These are more general notions than just the sort of states that we have at a given time. So for example, a transformation matrix would be an example of a generalized state. The idea of the composition principle is that, you take some composite object and you have some way of describing how it's put together. And then you want to be able to deduce the generalized state of that composite object. And that generalized state should be calculable by means of a calculation having the same structure as the description of the composite object. So here's an example. So here's a circuit. So insert joke about the pointer here. This is a circuit, and these boxes refer, these symbols here refer to boxes in a laboratory, okay? So they're in Kevin's laboratory here, for example, so he has a name for them. But then associated with these boxes are some mathematical objects that we use when we do calculations. So this is really just a name for a particular box. Whereas this mathematical object is a bunch of numbers, a tensor. So you associate with each of these objects a generalized state. So these are the generalized states. And then if you combine two of the objects, then you combine the generalized states in the same way. And so this is in accord with the composition principle. And this works very well with the theory of circuits, probabilistic circuits, and indeed in quantum theory as well. What's that, sorry? So they would correspond to the system types. These labels in sans serif font would correspond to the system types. So A might mean an electron. These ones in normal maths font, the italics maths font, are indices in a tensor. Okay. Right. So I've been thinking about these kinds of problems of quantum gravity and general relativity in an operational context for a while. The first paper I wrote on this was the causaloid framework, which was a framework for probabilistic theories where you didn't have definite causal structure. I developed this thing called the duotensor framework, which is a way to do probability theory for circuits but in a sort of manifestly covariant manner, manifestly covariant at the level of circuits. So this is for circuits, but it's also applicable if you think about regions of space-time. You imagine you could have, for example, fields on space-time. Then you could also apply this framework. I discussed that in this paper. And then based on top of that, you can actually formulate quantum theory in this kind of framework. So this is the operator tensor formulation. And then more recently, I developed what I call the theory of composition in physics. These sort of deep ideas that I just mentioned seem to be playing a role over and over, and it seems like they might play a role in the development of quantum gravity, ultimately. So lots of people have been thinking about these kinds of things. So I was very strongly motivated by the work of Chris Fuchs and his collaborators. You heard Rüdiger talk yesterday. And then also by the work of the of Abramsky and Kirker in Oxford. And there's been a lot of work on generalized probability theories, historical and also more recent. And then here's a whole bunch of space-time approaches to quantum theory. So so we heard Giulio talk. In the quantum information community, people aren't necessarily so aware of this work by Robert Urkel, which I think is very relevant to the kind of stuff we're doing. So he has, going back to 2004, this general boundary formulation of quantum theory, of quantum field theory, and in the context of quantum gravity. And he's been refining those ideas more recently. So just to illustrate this idea that Chris has a lot of these very motivational pictures. Here's a picture that he has, which is kind of relevant for the way I've been thinking. That you can imagine you have agents who are sort of setting things and making observations on a whole bunch of boxes. He calls this, he had this picture on his office door here for a long time. It said quantum cosmology. So you can imagine sort of building up a picture of the world from lots of little boxes around you. Okay. So in general relativity, that's the topic of today's talk. We have a whole bunch of fields. We have the metric, which is the gravitational field. Then we have a whole bunch of matter fields, which can be various different types of things. I'm just going to represent all those fields by this bold face phi. And we have a set of partial differential equations, including the Einstein's field equation. And so when we want to find a solution, we find a solution for those fields on a manifold, which is consistent with those equations. So at each point on the manifold, we have to specify the fields like this. So we give, this is what we give, and I'm provocatively calling this psi. So in general relativity, if phi, if this is a solution, if psi is a solution, then also you can perform a diffeomorphism which actively transforms the fields to a different location on the manifold. It moves them over the manifold. This object will also be a solution. And it has the same physical content. So this is sort of very deep, and it's maybe not so familiar to people from the quantum foundations community. And I could spend a lot of time talking about it, but I don't have time. But the key thing is that these are two different, these things look very different, but they have the same physical content. I want to introduce agency into general relativity. And that's not normally the way people think of general relativity. Normally people think of general relativity, well, if you want to get a solution, you choose some initial boundary conditions, then you use canonical formulation of general relativity, and you evolve forward in time, and then you get a solution for the whole universe. It's a block universe point of view. But you could think differently. You could imagine, here's an example. Imagine that you have, a captain is steering a spaceship. So he's sitting there, and the spaceship is a big thing. It has a lot of mass. And he decides whether to steer it to the left or the right. If he steers one way, then the gravitational fields, the other fields will be affected in one way. If he steers it the other way, they'll be affected in another way. Now, you could solve for for that situation in the block universe point of view. So what you'd have to do is you'd have to look at the neurons in his brain, extrapolate them back to the beginning, you know, your initial time slice at the beginning of the universe, and then solve, and you would get a solution, and it would determine, you know, determine what the captain was going to do. But that's not a very practical way to go about solving this situation. So instead, what you could do is you could coarse grain over information like the exact positions of the neurons in the brain of the captain, and treat his decision in an effective way. So you introduce it when it's necessary. So the idea is you have to introduce agency. So here's an example. Well, to make it more amenable to general relativity, let's imagine we have a vast fleet of spaceships like this, and it's so vast that you can think of it as forming a dust fluid. And then this dust fluid interacts with some other fluid, I'll call it the wind fluid. And you can imagine that these little spaceships actually have sails on them. There have been designs for spaceships like this that interact with the wind fluid, and that's how the spaceship is steered. And then you could write down an expression for the force density on the ship, which is equal to this. This is the covariant derivative of the stress energy tensor associated with the ship, and give it some form. So this is just something I plucked out of the air. Here's an example. But the important thing is that this has a field here that you've introduced that is determined by how the captains at each point in this ship fluid set their sails. So this, you can think of this as an agency field. It's a field that conveys agency. Now, it's an effective notion, because you could, in principle, always treat the neurons in the brains of all these captains and take them back to the initial time slice, but it's a useful, effective notion. Now, once you've introduced this kind of notion of agency, you imagine that it can only affect what happens in the future. That's kind of implicit in the way you're dealing with this. So it means that you have to introduce a second effective field, which I call a time direction field, so tau, which picks out in this light cone. The light cone is decided by the metric at this point. It picks out one direction over the other direction. So it points into what I call the forward or the future light cone. There is, of course, tremendous gauge freedom in choosing this vector field, because at each point, it can be any vector in here. So sigma is the gauge freedom. If for any tau, you can find a tau prime, and where sigma is a transformation that leaves the time orientation unchanged. So now we've introduced these two effective fields. What we have is a new solution which includes all the various fields we talked about before, the agency field. So we're going to think of this in general. It could be captain steering a fleet of spaceships, or it could be some other kind of situation involving agency. So this is the general object for that. A time direction field, and we have this specified at each point on the manifold. And the group, now the gauge group associated with this situation is, well, we still have the diffeomorphism freedom I mentioned before, but we also have this gauge freedom associated with the time direction field. So we can act on any solution with a diffeomorphism and a time orientation preserving transformation acting only on tau. So it acts only on this piece.
Which in addition to the diffeomorphism gauge invariants, here is a local Lorentz gauge invariant, which could be restricted to those that are future.
Right. Variables. Yeah. So you could certainly write down sigma as in those terms using.
Okay. So
yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, in the paper, I have just a discussion of that. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is define what I call beables. So in the general relativity community, the thing I'm going to call beables are usually called observables. And the word beables actually comes from the quantum foundations community. And I think it's more appropriate for what I'm going to say. And then that leaves me free afterwards to use the word observables for a different purpose. This is a move that's designed to upset people, incidentally. So a beable is given by any function which has the property that it's invariant. So it has the same, it's a function of the solution, and it's the same function for all elements of the gauge group. Remember, this includes the diffeomorphism and the time and the time orientation preserving transformation. So locality is a big issue here, because there's no function that has this property that depends only on the fields in some localized part of the manifold. Because if there was such a function depending on the fields, you could move those fields somewhere else, and then you would have with the diffeomorphism in here, and so then it would be different. So there's a serious problem with locality. On the other hand, we know that our observations are local. So for example, here's a glass. It's right here. So we can, you know, we have all around us evidence that we have locality in the world. So there's a big problem. How do we bridge that gap? And the point of view I'm going to take is that from the point of view of discussing things we observe, the manifold is the wrong space to expect locality of those observables. And the correct space is this thing I'm going to call the WS space, after Hans Westman, who was mentioned in the last talk also, so he's getting he's got a run, and Sebastiano Sonego. Okay. The ideas I'm going to present here are sort of subtly different from the kind of ideas they had there. They were more interested they weren't interested in the operational kind of questions. So here I want to set up an operational notion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make an assertion about what observables are. So observables are a subset of beables. What I mean by observables is things that you directly observe. And I'm going to say that observables correspond to scalars having specified values in coincidence. Let me just pop forward. So here's, we have a bunch of scalars. I can just draw three here. Scalar one, scalar two, scalar three. These are scalar fields. And now a point in this space corresponds to scalar one having a certain value, scalar two having a certain value, and scalar three having a certain value. And those are the kind of things that make up what I call observables. Not all beables can be understood as corresponding to observables. On the other hand, well, let me just, here's an example of a scalar. So some object like this where you contract out all the indices. What I want to do in particular is I set up something, it's a bit like the Heisenberg cut in quantum theory. So I set up I nominate a particular set of scalars that you can generate from these the gravitational and matter fields. And I give them these names, S1 up to SK. And this set of scalars has to be rich enough to capture our experience. So this is a lot like what you do in quantum theory when you say, well, these quantum systems are the ones that we observe, so we make a cut. It's very similar to that. So now what you can do is you can take a solution psi, and plot it into this space. Just pop forward again. So I've plotted all the points in some solution into this space. And what happens is that surface, the surface that you get, has a few interesting features. First of all, the surface is invariant under diffeomorphisms. It doesn't move because scalars having values in coincidence at a certain point x, where you can change the label, the x label, but that doesn't change the position in the space. And then also this surface has intrinsic dimension, which is less than or equal to the dimension of the manifold. Because all the fields, all the scalar fields are controlled by the coordinate. So if you move around in coordinate space, it's impossible to move around in more than four dimensions. So the intrinsic dimension of this surface has to be four or less. It's possible for this surface to pinch down. And this surface could also be very irregular. So I said earlier that the manifold is the wrong space to do operational physics. This, I claim, is the right space to do operationalism. Lee?
So two remarks. One of them is that this idea is usually associated with Peter Bergman.
My understanding is he just talked about using a set of scalars to give you a coordinate system, whereas here this is slightly more democratic. These could be also the quantities that you're interested in. So Westman and Sonego were a bit more democratic in some sense.
But in any case, there's a criticism of this strategy which is made by Ted Newman, which is that if generosity is a chaotic system and reduction definition is chaotic, then the important variables are not going to be differentiable on the space.
I mean, it's true. I need here to assume that your fields are all smooth, and so I'm going to make that kind of assumption. Sure.
But that's probably equivalent to the assumption of generality of the neural system.
Probably, yeah. I mean, my feeling is I don't really see an alternative option. If you're going to make operational statements about this, and you actually think about the kind of things we observe in the world, they always correspond to measuring quantities in coincidence. So I don't really see much of an alternative. I think you can look at the various proposals that have been made, like the Bergman proposal or Carlo Rovelli talking about GPS, but you can think of all those examples as special cases of this more general picture.
Yes, I know.
So this seems to me like the best general picture you can have. But maybe I should get on because there's a long discussion here. And I want to use this now to set up operationalism. Okay, so let's go back to agency. Well, you can only set things that you observe. When you say, I did this or I did that, well, you know what this or that is. It's something that you can observe. So we also need to describe our agent choices by sets of scalars, by that same assertion. So we do that. We imagine we can extract a set of scalars. Here's one way of doing it. You can extract some scalars that depend also on the matter on the fields that we had earlier. So there could be some more general way, but the point is you extract some set of scalars. You want to extract a set of scalars which capture the sorts of choices you make. And then an agency strategy is where you specify these scalars as a function of S, where you are in the space, for all values in the space. So you're saying what I would do at every point in my space. Okay, and that's an agency strategy. So now a useful way of thinking about this is to sort of do what I call turning the solution inside out. So the solution depends on phi and chi. But we could imagine that there's a one-to-one map between this set of fields and the scalars in S, the scalars in Q, and then some additional stuff. The trick here is to work out how to write down what the additional stuff is. In the worst case scenario is the additional stuff is just this original set of fields, but you can be more efficient than that. And you would really want to find a way of choosing this additional stuff so that it doesn't include the information that's already been specified here and here. And I have some strategies for doing that, but I haven't got a general strategy for doing that. Okay, so this gives you these omegas, which is the additional stuff beyond S and Q. And now I want to define the lambdas. Incidentally, lambda in the quantum foundations literature is the symbol that's used always to specify hidden variables. So that's the way I'm thinking about this. So the lambdas is now a function on S, and it's going to depend on this object M sub S. That's the part of the manifold having a given value of S. So for a given point in this WS space, we have some set of the manifold, which could just be a single point, or it could be some bigger region of the manifold. So and so we define this to be the hidden variables are given by specifying for each point in this part of the manifold associated with S, you specify these omegas, which came from here, the stuff left over, and also the time direction field. Time direction field is a vector. It's not immediately observable, although you can imagine, so it's a hidden variable, but you can imagine observing it indirectly. For example, you could set off a causal puffball. If you blow one of those dandelions and the thing spread everywhere, and that will tell you, you know, which direction is forward in time.
Why is the time direction
correlated? It's not correlated. It's just, I'm just specifying. I'm including.
The observed arrow of time. Why is that field?
So that field is. It's an effective field. In the fundamental formulation, these effective fields aren't there. But because we're treating captain's decisions effectively, we need then also to specify which direction they propagate forward in. And actually, for a long time, this tau is going to be decoupled from what I say. It only comes in at the end when I impose a certain causality condition. But that's off in the future. That's the part of the talk I won't get to. okay, so if you do that, then the you can take the solution and you can represent it in this sort of inside-out fashion. So you have S, you have the value of Q, the choice of the agent at that point in S, then you also have the hidden variables lambda at that point, and you have to specify this for every S in this surface. So it's sort of like this. You have this surface. Then at each point in here, you have a choice of, you have Q, which is the agent's choice, and lambda. And these two things are interconvertible. And they both present useful ways of thinking about the solution. OK. Well, I'm interested in compositionality. So I want to look at little bits of the world, and I'm going to do that in WS space because that's the right space to look at operational facts. So let's draw a box in WX space, and that box will intersect this gamma surface in some small surface, which is gamma A. There it is. And so in this region, the solution is just given by the values of these variables at points inside gamma A. Okay, so this is the solution restricted to this region A. And now remember, we had an agency strategy where we select an agent's choice at every point in the whole space. But inside this box, the agent strategy is given by just by specifying what the agent would do at points inside that box. So it's given by QA. Okay. So now we've got these ideas, we can start to define propositions pertaining to parts of this space. So we have two kinds of propositions. Operational propositions, these are the kind of propositions we can actually verify in principle by making observations. We can directly verify them. And a basic operational proposition would be to say that in the region A, the surface is some gamma sub A. Okay. A coarse-grained version of that would be to say, well, in that region of WS space, the proposition is one of a set. The surface gamma corresponds to one of a set of possible surfaces. So you have lots of different surfaces inside that little box. And if one of those is true, then your proposition is true. Okay. We can also form ontic propositions. So before I do that, I want to do something heavy-handed, which is define psi tilde to be what you get when you act psi tilde A is what you get when you act on psi A with all elements of this group. Okay, so it's a very ugly object, but it's a useful thing to introduce. So this object is an invariant now under the gauge group. And you can say, well, a basic proposition is that inside the region A, we have some particular solution. I'm going to call these candidate solutions because we're talking about propositions. So here's a candidate solution inside the region A. And a coarse-grained example is where we have one of a set. So if one of these solutions is true, then that describes the ontological situation inside that region. And operational propositions can be written as a coarse-grained ontic proposition. So you just take all the solutions, all the candidate solutions which are consistent with the particular gamma that you have. Okay. So what we've done so far is we've set up this particular space, which I claim is the correct space to do operationalism in the context of general relativity. And then we've set up how you think about solutions in that space. And now we've set up how you think about propositions. Okay. I thought it was fun to think about this, the principle of general compositionality. The laws of physics should be written in such a way that they apply to any compositional description of any object and in terms of a calculation having the same compositional structure as this description. This is an attempt to do something like the principle of general covariance. The similarity between these two things is that we have some very general idea for how to formulate physical theories that may help us get to the right mathematical structure. How am I doing for time? Okay, so now I want to define a thing I call... Afterwards, great, okay, good. So now I want to define a thing, I call this an encapsulated proposition. So this is a set of, a bunch of objects. We have a, and this is associated, I meant to draw a diagram here. So we have some region inside the WS space. We just represent that as two-dimensional. And on this region, we have various parts of the boundary. And I'm going to give them directions. And another one. And the directions are, so B is an outward pointing one, A is inward pointing, and C is outward pointing. So we have a general region. This is actually reminiscent of the stuff that Robert Urkel does. And it has different parts of the boundary, and I give them different letters. Okay, so an encapsulated proposition is where we take some region of the WS space, we consider some particular proposition pertaining to that region, we have some agency strategy inside that region, and also we have a bunch of directed surfaces that enclose the region. And we can represent this object diagrammatically in this sort of abstract way. Just as a circle with these different arrows coming in and out, representing the boundary regions. And now we can simplify an encapsulated proposition using physics. So if we assume that something that can't happen according to the physics is just simply not true, then we can look at this proposition and we can prune all the aspects of that proposition that simply can't happen according to the physics. So we start with some proposition like this, but now we can simplify by taking out all the candidate solutions inside this region that cannot actually correspond to the physical theory. And now we can consider combining encapsulated propositions. So we use this kind of notation. Oh, there's a typo here. No, there's not a typo. So we have two encapsulated propositions, and they meet on their surfaces. They meet at some particular. They meet in some particular region. So we have A. The typo is that this A should be a C. They meet. In some particular part of their boundary, like this, and we can represent that symbolically like this, and we see we have a repeated index. We have A appears twice and C appears twice, and here we have the diagrammatic notation for the same thing. And now what we can do is we can simplify this kind of encapsulated proposition by using physical matching. So it gets a bit subtle. But the idea is that you look at all the candidate solutions that you have in there, and you prune so that you only keep cases that match in an appropriate way. So the idea is you impose some physical, you have some conditions, and these conditions are such that if they're matched on both sides of the boundary, then the solution that you get for the joint region is actually an allowed solution, satisfies the field equations. And this should work because we have local field equations, we have partial differential equations. So this is a way to combine these encapsulated propositions and pick out the propositions that are physically possible. Right. Okay, good. So those conditions take certain values. And we can construct this object, which is another heavy-handed object, where we just take we have the whole set of such conditions under the gauge group, so this object A really just captures what's happening at the boundary in a diffeomorphism invariant way. I'll skip that bit. And now, when you have an encapsulated proposition, assuming this is an operational one, so this is something you could actually measure. But associated with this, there will be lots of different ontological propositions. And we can imagine that we have a probability density over those different ontological propositions, which will correspond to different matching conditions at the boundary. Okay. So this object is now a whole bunch of probability densities for different values of the matching conditions. It's very similar to the tensor I talked about at the beginning, except it's got continuous rather than discrete indices. And now, what we can do is associated with each encapsulated proposition, we can associate one of these objects, which is a list of probability densities. And so this is the generalized state. And then we can combine them by not summing, but integrating over the repeated indices. So once we've done this, we can use the machinery of the duotensor framework that I'd set up before. I'm not going to give you the details of that. I just want to give you a sense of how it works. So for example, imagine we have some region, and we know we're interested in what the relative probability is associated with two different encapsulated propositions. Well, we can associate generalized states with each of these. And you can show that if these two generalized states are proportional, then you can make then this relative probability is well conditioned. It doesn't depend on what's happening outside the associated region of the WS space. And furthermore, the relative probability is equal to this coefficient k of proportionality. So this kind of approach allows us to do calculations in the face of having indefinite or fuzzy causal structure. One thing we're going to need to do is write down what the appropriate conditions are on these mathematical objects, these generalized states. Okay, there's a stray matrix, a stray bracket there. So one way to think about this is just, this is just a cartoon is, well, in special relativity, you can set the metric everywhere to be the Minkowski metric. And then when you go to general, the metrics satisfies this equation. Well, over here we have this thing, the Pavia causality condition. Julia mentioned it yesterday. This is the idea that the deterministic effect is unique, or equivalently that the future can't influence the past. And so what we need is an appropriate causality condition here. In this sense. I have an idea for this, although I haven't written it down properly, but it will use this time direction field. This is the first time that the time direction field has actually made an appearance in any sort of physics here. So what I've done is I've indicated a route to an operational probabilistic formulation of general relativity, including agency. There's various challenges remain, some of a technical nature, and some other things I want to do, which I haven't talked about. So introducing fiducials is a very good thing to do in operational formulations of and operational probability theories. But what I wanted to finish with was just how to sketch a route to quantum gravity motivated by this approach. So the thing we've been talking about is this pager. Over here we have operational quantum theory. It's the kind of thing that people have been talking about at this conference in previous days. And then down here we have classical probability theory. I'm thinking of classical probability theory on a fixed background, so a circuit, for example. As we go from here to here, the sort of quantization process, what's happening is that the classical probability simplexes are being replaced by the curved convex sets of quantum theory that derive from a Hilbert space. And as we go from here to here, we're going from having a fixed causal structure to a sort of a fuzzy causal structure. And then the hope is that we can use this and this to triangulate onto the thing I call QAGER, quantum general relativity with agency, or the next BlackBerry operating system. And that's it. Thank you.